Michael Beale. Mike is assistant professor of radio television at Morehead State University and was previously on the staff at University of Missouri in Columbia and the head of the Northwestern University Radio Archives. He's been quite active in ARSC, as well as being a private collector, broadcaster, and edits from time to time for the record column of the ARSC Journal. And Mike will introduce the remainder of the panel.
Okay, thank you very much. It's great to have a panel this size to talk about a subject that seems to often make us as lonely as Maytag washing machine repairmen, spoken word records. As you know, we're a comparative rare breed, and unfortunately, in today's profit-minded, accountant-run record business, the spoken word record releases seem to have almost completely vanished. With the exception of several companies who specialize in this type of product, practically none are released, and even fewer remain in the catalogs. As a matter of fact, we are afraid that some of these I Can Hear It Now recordings, which we thought were still in print, may have already been deleted by Columbia without us knowing in the last couple of years. In addition, though, our category is relegated to the obscurity of Schwann 2, which makes them as good as being cut out. They've been banished along with the other unimportant recordings that had the misfortune to have either been born mono or pop records over the ripe old age of 2 years. These distinctions make even less sense than the habit of radio program tape traders listing people alphabetically by their first name. Well, enough of the editorializing. Before we get into our subject tonight, Helen Roach has asked if she can make a short statement also on the idea of spoken word records. We'll let her introduce what she wanted to say.
I'm very grateful for this opportunity. Mike asked me to be on the panel, but I've spent the past 2 years collecting letters from the faculty of my college, which is celebrating its 50th anniversary this year. So I've been over my head, both as a collector, editor, a publisher, and now salesman. And so I could not say yes to Mike. But when I realized that today was Shakespeare's birthday, and I'm a cuckoo about Shakespeare, I thought, well, I should tell you about my experience in 1964. And now, Mike, will you begin 3 minutes and say this when the 3 minutes are up and give me two more sentences. But I did feel that it was worthy of this group's presentation on Shakespeare's birthday because I was a representative of the Speech Association of America at Stratford-on-Avon at the quattercentenary in 1964. And I would like to tell you, I was standing in the post office about to leave and had mailed all my cards to the people who were going to get cards from Stratford on his birthday. And all of a sudden, the band at the end of the street struck up. And then there was a signal. And at the base of each one of maybe 30 flagpoles stood a representative of a country. And then at the signal, and some of these were ambassadors, some of them were very important, distinguished people. You see the way they looked, how important they must have been. And then at the signal, all of the flags went up. And so at Stratford for the birthday, that was something extremely beautiful. And then there was a procession to the Shakespeare was buried. And in that procession were these dignitaries, all of them carrying wreaths or floral offerings. And then there were a number of people with a hand across the breast and some little sprig. And I found out from an Englishman afterward that was the proper way to celebrate Shakespeare's birthday, with a sprig of rosemary. So everybody had these gorgeous presentations, but they were not as appropriate as they might have been. Then at lunchtime, I was able to get seat number 748 under a great big tent to take care of 750 people. And it was addressed, that luncheon, not by Her Royal Highness, but Her Royal Highness representative. That was the Duke of Edinburgh. And then they presented Henry IV, I guess it was, at the theater, and in the evening there was a big, big representation. But I just wanted to tell you how wonderful it was to hear the flag, see the flags of the nations, and see the whole world turning out for the birthday, as well as me.
Thank you very much, Helen. Now, we are here today to discuss the commercially released recordings of one of the foremost contributors to the world of documentary records, Edward R. Murrow. Now, 30 years ago, our esteemed friend Phil Miller did a review on Volume 3 of I Can Hear It Now and said, aside from recalling the personalities and events, nostalgia is induced by the use of unforgettable tunes of the day and by slogans still familiar. I wonder how all this strikes the younger generation. Well, we are here as representatives of that younger generation of that particular day to tell you how it struck us. Now, I grew up in the 1950s and can honestly say that the three I Can Hear It Now albums were an important part of my life. They introduced me to the love of 20th century history and the effectiveness of a well-produced audio production. It was a large part of my interest in broadcasting, which became my career, and I'm sure that Gary can say much the same thing as the other members of our panel, and to some degree as well. It's ironic that the first bulletin I ever broke into a broadcast with was this one, the announcement from UPI at 2:01 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, May 27th, 1965, of Edward R. Murrow's death. Now, we were supposed to have another member on our panel who is not here this afternoon, and Gary will tell you for a moment why he is not.
I just want to take a brief moment to say how disappointed we are that Ed Bliss can't be with us. You see from the notes on the speakers that he was closely associated with Murrow as Murrow's writer and editor for the last 5 years of his radio series from 55 to 60, and later edited one of the Columbia albums of Murrow's broadcasts and the Alfred Knopf book of Murrow's broadcasts, In Search of Light. Ed Bliss is on this campus, but he was suddenly taken ill this morning. He's hospitalized, and they haven't yet identified what his ailment is, so I can't report to be very cheerful about his condition. Only assure you that we are on his minds, and he's called to let us know that he's sorry he can't be with you, and I will assure him that he's on your minds too.
Well, those of us who are here, we have George F. Henderson, who's come all the way from Odessa, Ontario. He's been spending many years locating and cataloging every Murrow recording in existence. And if your archive includes any original recordings of Murrow that might be unique, please talk to him later about it. Another tidbit of information is that, for those of you who are interested mostly in jazz, is that the F in his name stands for Fletcher, but you're not the famous Fletcher Henderson pianist, so we just thought we might bring that in. Also, last on our panel, who is not listed in the program, at least for this panel, is Martin Werber, who is the head of the CBS Radio Audio Archive. And of course, Murrow spent all of his professional commercial broadcasting career over at CBS. And he has some things to say and was the one who informed us of the existence of that Volume 4. Now, 1948 was a relatively important year in the record industry. It marked the introduction of the LP, the start of the use of magnetic tape for mastering records, and the release of the original Volume 1, Columbia ML4095 and MM800. Gary is going to explain how these three developments are intimately intertwined. As an introduction, we want you to hear an edited version of a rather interesting promotional event which accompanied the release of Volume 1. Near the end of 1948, program number 441 of The Voice of the Army was recorded at ABC Radio, and it features Murrow narrating about 8 minutes of segments from the album, which, by the way, are played off of 78 RPMs. There we go.
I Can Hear It Now, presenting Edward R. Murrow from New York City. The U.S. Army and the U.S. Air Force present a program of historical significance featuring the distinguished radio commentator Edward R. Murrow. This transcribed feature is another in the series of the voice of the Army.
This is the news to all Americans who depend on their radios for the up-to-the-minute news reporting that has helped make broadcasting a part of our daily lives. Edward R. Murrow's This is the News is well known indeed, for he is one of the leading figures in radio and news reporting and has been called by his reporting colleagues the newscaster's newscaster. Ed, it's a real pleasure to welcome you to Voice of the Army.
Thank you, Joe Ripley. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
As most of our audience knows, I Can Hear It Now is more than the title of this program. It is the name of your new Columbia Masterworks album, which has created a stir all over the country. Ed, what gave you the idea for I Can Hear It Now?
Well, Joe, I'm a reporter, and I Can Hear It Now represents a sound history of what I consider to be the most fateful and exciting 13 years in civilization. From 1933, when Franklin D. Roosevelt took the presidential oath of office in Washington, to 1945, when General Douglas MacArthur took the Japanese surrender in Tokyo Bay, much happened. Each year brought news stories and personalities that seemed to overshadow those that preceded them. It was an era for the ear. Radio grew from the crystal set to the AM/FM consoles of today. Future events will perhaps be televised and recorded visually. But these eventful years were years of sound.
These are the sounds of days that are past.
The sound quality?
We record a new dimension of history. A scrapbook of sounds from 13 years of violence and achievement. Part of the greatest mass adventure man has yet undertaken. A voice can cut through the hazy fog of time and bring yesterday's images sharply into focus.
A newsman generally looks ahead to tomorrow's news. But in this reporter's opinion, the events leading up to this atomic age should be studied by us and our children, for there are lessons to be gained, lessons for all of us.
Ed, let me thank you on behalf of all of us on Voice of the Army and our audience for bringing us I Can Hear It Now. I know I speak for everyone when I say that it's been one of our finest programs. I know, too, that our audience will look forward to hearing and owning your entire Columbia Masterworks album, I Can Hear It Now.
Thank you, Joe Ripley. Goodbye. And good luck.
Featured on today's show was Edward R. Murrow, distinguished radio commentator, with recordings from his Columbia album of I Can Hear It Now. This program was written, produced, and directed by Charles Wilkes. This is Joe Ripley speaking. This transcribed feature has been another in the series of The Voice of the Army.
What you've heard have been some excerpts from that, I think it was a 15-minute program originally.
Right.
And it reminds us that you can edit tape, which is what Mike has done with this and what we did this afternoon with the parts of Volume 4 we'll hear. You could not edit discs. It was really hard to splice a disc like a piece of pie and take out an actuality from somebody's speech. That is why the advent of magnetic tape recording in 1947-48 in that broadcast season made it possible to produce a record like I Can Hear It Now. There were some actuality programs before that. But primarily, the news documentary programs of the period were March of Time and You Are There, and they had actors recreating the events of the week. They rarely used actuality excerpts from actual speeches of actual newsmakers or actual interviews. Most of the material was recreated by actors. Robert Louis Cheyenne was the producer of You Are There for CBS, and he wrote in 1951 that high-fidelity tape makes possible more speed and flexibility in handling and a fuller flowering of the technique, this documentary technique, at less cost. Another of the factors, and these are things you are aware of, but what I wanted to do was make you aware of the configuration of these events, because I think collectively they caused the possibility of this album. The second was the Musicians Union Recording Band of 1948, which lasted through much of that year. It was the second one and was considerably less devastating than the first from 42 to 44 for 2.5 years. But there was one in 1948, and it was particularly devastating at that moment in the history of the phonograph because of the third event I want to talk about, the advent of the LP, which Columbia introduced in June of 1948. At the very moment when Columbia had a new configuration for recorded sound, a new medium to release records on, at that very moment, they didn't have any new recordings because of the Musicians Union recording ban. Fred Friendly recalled in 1967 that Goddard Lieberson was faced with one of Jimmy Petrillo's perennial musician strikes, and for this reason, he agreed, against others' advice, to take a chance on my idea. The idea was a documentary history of that most compelling period of the century, at least up to that time, 1933 to 1945, the Roosevelt years, and that became volume one of I Can Hear It Now, produced by, written and produced by Friendly and narrated by Murrow. I want to say again how disappointed I am that Ed Bliss isn't with us. I had lunch with him the day before yesterday, and he hurried back to his office to take a call from Joe Wershba at CBS. Ed's understanding was that Joe Wershba physically spliced the tape for this first record, and Joe Wershba had called him to tell him stories about that, and in fact called him back this morning to correct some of the stories he told him the other day and add to them. I'm terribly disappointed that we don't have Ed here to tell us those stories, and hopefully they'll appear in the journal or the newsletter or someplace, at least among us, in the near future.
What I was just looking at, as you have noticed on the multicolored, on the black and white discography that I've listed there, there is a series of acknowledgments on volume one. It's listed on the first page. I don't have the actual acknowledgments that appeared in no other album form but the 78 RPM version. They never put the acknowledgments on the LP, even though the original LP is this very rare foldover. This is probably and the first foldover LP jacket that was ever put out, because this is 1948, when almost every other Columbia LP was the Tombstone or the Music Stand. So I don't know whether it's their first illustrated cover, but I think it's their first foldover, and this is just a paper flap. It's not heavy cardboard. Of course, that is one of several different cover versions, and as you've noticed, we have a table piled high with almost every conceivable variation on every one of Edward R. Murrow's albums. There are a few that we don't have examples of right here, such as the 45 RPM version. I know of only one person who owns a copy of it, and I didn't have a chance to get him to send it down here so that we could see it. But I want to give you, this was going to be the introduction that I was going to give for Ed Bliss, that there really is a, Murrow was more than just a newscaster, he was a journalist and one of the greatest writers that broadcasting has ever seen. Now I have a recording here that can very quickly show you what we mean and what made him so extra special. A few years ago, for some unknown reason, Columbia Musical Treasuries offered an album which utilized all of the actuality recordings from Volume 1, but was based on a new script with a new narrator. The contrast is startling. Now, here's the narration near the beginning of the albums, right after FDR's first inaugural address about the depth of the Depression. The only thing we have to fear is fear itself, leading into a critical recording by Huey Long about FDR. Now, the narrator on the new recording is Ralph F. Conlin, Jr., and the producer was Betsy Cohen, whoever they are.
The first year of the New Deal was vigorous, desperate, experimental, and like a surgeon's most powerful drugs, dangerous. Franklin Roosevelt and his corps of political practitioners, Hopkins, Tugwell, Moley, Wallace, and Hugh Johnson, created the most controversial administration since Lincoln's. And yet, either because of it or in spite of it, the patient revived and prospered. Production and employment were up. The soup kitchens and the apple stands disappeared. But a nervous America was still not sufficiently removed from panic to disregard completely the promises and plans of political soothsayers such as Townsend, Coghlan, and Huey Long. In Washington, Roosevelt had gathered together a motley crew of brain trusters, and in the first 100 days of his administration, pushed sweeping programs through a willing Congress. Everyone, it seemed, had a program. The political boss, former governor and senator from Louisiana, Huey Long, had his own.
Now, what, we were hoping that Ed Bliss would be able to give us some idea about the way that Murrow worked. And this was not going to follow immediately after something which was praiseworthy of Murrow. What I want to do is make some statements, I won't give you the full presentation because of time limitations, about volume 3 of I Can Hear It Now, which is the one which came out third yet covers the first time period, the 1919 to 1932 time period. Murrow's integrity is unquestioned, but unfortunately he was responsible for this one project which continues to cause repeated problems for us audio historians and other searchers for the truth. Now, following a tradition as old as the 1890 cylinders of the mad ravings of John McCullough, the last words of Harry T. Hayward, and the discs of William McKinley's speech, continuing through Time Magazine's 1930 syndicated radio program News Acting and their network show, The March of Time, and also things like CBS You Are There, Murrow Friendly used actors' voices along with some real voices in this volume 3. Now, it was only after the first two records were issued that they decided to go back for that retrospective. And I might also add that in the three-record box set, as I indicated in the discography, they renumbered the volumes so that people wouldn't be confused why volumes 1 and 2 came after volume 3. Now, the first two albums had a reputation for reliability and authenticality of the recorded inserts. Except for some miscellaneous sound effects, all of the recordings are real, and in one or two cases, they had somebody come back into the studio to say the words that weren't recorded, but they listed that on the album. But in 1950, we were still within the above-cited tradition about the March of Time and other numerous radio-dramatic, poetic documentaries by Norman Corwin and You Are There, and even Dragnet was considered a documentary when it first went on the air in 1950, for some strange reason. But it made it acceptable back then to include dramatic recreations within a documentary, and today this is considered unforgivable. It's akin to falsifying the news. Broadcasters have been cited by the FCC for just staging news and documentaries if all they did was plan the events that they were covering rather than just stumbling across them. And last week at the Washington Post, the Pulitzer Prize winning writer resigned when it was discovered that she had fabricated a story about an 8-year-old heroin addict. But back then, productions like The March of Time made no apologies for having actors reenact or staging the actions in the filmed or theatrical versions. But even then, Murrow and Friendly had reservations about the practice, and they stated it on the album jacket. This volume does not pretend to be spoken history, although we have not knowingly done violence to the truth. It is designed rather to remind you of some of the things that happened to us. In making the first two volumes, we were able to present the actual voices and the recorded sounds of events. Where we have been able to do this in the third volume, we have done so. We are acutely aware of the dangers involved in thus mixing actors and actual recordings. But there is no other way to do it. In no instance have we tampered with the text or testimony. It is all here as spoken. Now, it's comforting to know that their conscience was bothering them, at least to some extent. But I feel that they were not acutely aware enough of the dangers of mixing the actors and the actual recordings. If it had been all actors, I don't think we would have complained at all. I feel that most people would think that the majority of the recordings were real, that only a small fraction were with actors, but that's not the case. And as you can see from the listing that we've given out, only two of the several dozen voices are real recordings made by the actual people during the time period of the album. And in both of these cases, there are reservations. There is a third recording of FDR on the album that is really an actor. And some of the five Will Rogers recordings might have come from the Gulf radio program, which was on the air after the time period covered by the album. I haven't had time to locate which one each of those five Rogers recordings is from. Now, nine other people, and that's counting Gosson and Carell as two people, with the possibility that William Allen White might have been portrayed by an actor. I don't have any other recordings of his voice, so I'm not sure. Do you?
I do, and I think that's an actor on this record.
You think that's an actor, okay. So eight other people. that they were recreating things which in some cases they didn't even have any part in the original event. I hope we'll be able to get to some of these instances. Only two of the nine pieces of music played were actual recordings from the era, the Crosby and Valley recordings. All others were later recordings. Some of them were artificially filtered to sound old. Now, Murrow and Friendly used the excuse that during the era we are treating, radio was in its infancy, and so were the talkings. Recordings of individuals are either non-existent or of poor quality. But one of the credits on the second version of the liner notes, and you'll notice on the second page there that there are two different sets of acknowledgments and bibliography on the two different rear covers on the LP versions. On the second version, this appears. Robert Vincent, who has one of the finest historical record collections in the world and who supplied us with much material. Now, I'm at a loss to discover what Bob Vincent could have supplied that was used for any purpose except to be mimicked by the actors. Several other documentary albums now came out within a year or two that proved that even with the reproduction available during the 1950s, there were many acceptable quality recordings that of many of the participants in this album. Things like Hark the Years, for example. It's one of only about 10 albums that came out by 1952, 53, and 54. Hark the Years. Oh, now there were several other albums, for example, on RCA Victor, The Quick and the Dead, which Fred Friendly did in 1950, which was from an NBC radio broadcast of four broadcasts about the atom and the hydrogen bomb. They included the names on the album jackets of who the actors were and which voices they portrayed. And Showbiz, which was an album with Georgie Jessel, which also was from an NBC broadcast, also listed the specific people who were portrayed by actors, although I think they lied in Danny Kaye's case, because I'm sure that that's Danny Kaye, but yet Danny Kaye was under contract to Decca. They may have lied on the album cover just to cover up the fact that that really is Danny Kaye on the record, but I can't be sure. Now, there's another danger that I really don't think the producers considered, that some people would not be given a chance to read the liner notes. There are many instances of inserts from the album used in other productions. And once you get several generations away from the original album, it is often not possible to use the clues of sound quality, which is one of the major clues of telling which are actors, to determine which recordings are real or recreated. Now, I'm going to try to play for a couple of minutes a few examples. Now, as I mentioned, I grew up with these albums, and the first thing that really turned me on to the idea that some of this was phony was when I noticed that there was a coincidence. The same Morse code interference that's present during the recording of KDKA from 1920, and one of the international broadcasts heard in a montage about Lindbergh 7 years later, were exactly the same.
We'll give you the state vote in just a moment. But first, we'd like to ask you to let us know if this broadcast is reaching you. Please drop us a card, address station KDKA, Westinghouse, East Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
This is station 2RN Dublin calling. The American flyer Lindbergh passed over Dingle Bay on the Irish coast at a low altitude at 1:30 this afternoon.
It would seem that 7 years of hard work at the pounding the brass key would have made the guy slow down rather than speed up a little bit. Most of the sound effects were played on CBS sound trucks, which, if you've ever seen them, are wheeled vehicles with a loudspeaker and three turntables, and they are variable speed turntables. The sound effects pickup is microphone to speaker, and that is why the sound effects are usually of a lower sound quality than the voice recordings. They could have done it by direct wire, but you'd get more of the surface noise from the 78s that they were using for their sound effects. Now, let's give you another example that speed makes a difference. For example, here is the same recording, but it really all started, I think, some of the abuse of this album with the Longines Symphonette set that you've probably all seen, Jack Benny's Golden Memories of Radio. and it also has come out in several other versions as well. The late Frank Knight now introduces that same recording, but listen to what they did to it.
In the-